National Gallery Podcast.
Hello, this is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. Coming up in this month's show, Oliver Cromwell gets mixed up in the French Revolution, and we visit the archives to hear how a heavy-smoking, hard-drinking, penny-pinching duke changed the history of art collecting in Britain. But we start this episode with an introduction to the National Gallery's new associate artist. Every few years, a contemporary artist is invited to make the gallery their home. They work in a studio and have full access to the collection and everything that goes on behind the scenes. Previous incumbents have included Peter Blake, Paul Orego, and more recently, Alison Watt. The latest appointee is Michael Landy, famous for Breakdown, the 2001 project that saw him painstakingly catalogue and destroy every one of his possessions on London's Oxford Street. Colin Wiggins went along to say hello.
Michael, welcome. This is your first day in the empty studio. What do you think of it?
It's very nice. They've painted it in very nicely, and it's empty. It's a bit like my head at the moment, and we haven't got any furniture. I've brought my sketchbook, and I'm going to have a look at the collection today.
What was your first reaction when we invited you to come here and do this project?
Well, my first reaction was I thought you were pulling my leg. So I had to come here to find out whether there was a real Colin Wiggins. He really did exist. So I'm here. It's a bit like beginning college again. That's a couple without any more students. It's just me. But I kind of feel like slightly excited about it and slightly apprehensive. Ultimately, in the end, I you know, there's an exhibition at the end of it, and I get judged in the context of the collection and the grey artists. And so that's lucky. I'm a bit stupid, so it doesn't really scare me too much. But
did you have any doubts about undertaking the project? I mean, when you realised it was a genuine offer, did you think, oh yeah, I have to do that? Or did you think, oh, hang on a minute, maybe I'd best think about this?
I don't think it really took me too long, because I'm kind of intrigued about the whole thing. So I don't, obviously responding to art as well, which I don't, it's not normally what I do. It's not normally what I respond to. I mean, you know, daily rituals of life or whatever, the outside world, that's kind of more my thing. So I think responding to art is not something I think I'm kind of intrigued about drawing. I'd probably start by drawing and then see where it takes me.
And do you have any parts of the collection that you think you might head towards to start making these drawings?
No. Just. No, I'm just going to look. And I think that's probably what you want me to do at first, isn't it? I think it would be a problem if I just assumed that I knew exactly what I was going to do from the start. I think I'm an artist in residence, so I'm here, in a sense, to look and see what I feel is kind of appropriate. I kind of feel a bit like when I did my project semi-detached at Tate Britain, where I was basically like artist in residence at my parents' house. You know, I'd left home when I was 18, and I was like, you know, back there at age 40, and it's like a project about my father. But I suddenly became artist in residence at my house with a sketchbook and a pad, and I drew my dad. And I imagine it's going to be a similar thing here. Like, after a while, I'll just become part of the fixtures and fittings of the building, and people will get used to me being around.
It's nice that you say that. You're certainly not the first associate artist who said that. I think it's something that almost becomes the first thing that artists understand, that this amazing collection here, that they're dropped in the middle of it, and it's going to affect them in some way. And I think that the kinds of artists that we're looking for, this is exactly why we asked you, actually, Michael, is an artist who doesn't know what's going to happen. An artist who recognises that the collection is going to have a surprising impact on their work. I think the kinds of artists that we would not be interested in inviting to do this are artists who think they already know what they're going to do before they move in. And you spoke to Peter Blake, who is one of your predecessors.
I spoke to Peter.
Did he give you any hints?
Alison, he may have done, but I've forgotten them. That's a problem with me.
Thanks to Colin Wiggins, and good luck to Michael Landy. Now to our major exhibition of work by the French artist Delaroche. One of the star pictures of the show is Cromwell and Charles I. When this work went on display in 1831, it appeared to have plenty to say to the French about the revolutionary events of their recent past, despite its historic English subject matter. Leah Caribbean visited the exhibition with one of the show's curators, Stephen Bann, and began by asking him to describe this intriguing work.
Well, we see a coffin. We see Oliver Cromwell opening that coffin, and inside is the dead body of King Charles I, who has just been executed by order of the Parliament. Cromwell has a sword, he has a plumed hat. He is, one wouldn't say triumphant at all. It's certainly a much more introspective look, and in fact, quite what he was feeling, I think, has always been a matter for speculation, right from the initial stage at which this picture was exhibited.
So people were looking at this within the context of recent political French events, but how does that work? I mean, this is an image from Stuart history.
Yes, it's an image from Stuart history, but in the few years before, historians and men of letters, Guizot and Chateaubriand, had written very extensively to suggest that there was a close parallelism between the events in the English Civil War, the middle of the 17th century, and what had happened in their own country from the period of the French Revolution, that's to say from 1789 onwards. And this, therefore, was a way of looking at French history, but through the medium of the events of English history. And this juncture in which the king has been executed was clearly a real turning point in the English Civil War, and something which revived memories of the fact that their king, Louis XVI, had himself been guillotined not so many years before.
And I know that one critic, perhaps even the same critic, said that this picture strikes us all with its high morality. Now, what did he mean by that?
He meant that really it had a moral lesson for us, that's to say, us being the French people, that the great move to replace the king with a republic, in the English case, that had taken place in France as well, and it had its sad side, its unfortunate side, and its disastrous side, as well as, of course, having its progressive side. So it was a matter, really, of weighing up in front of a picture like this, and weighing up, really, through the introspective glance of Cromwell, the future that would spring from this act of regicide.
I mean, looking at this picture, which is very large and very striking, and it is very obvious that Charles had just been decapitated. That's a really nasty wound that we see all the way around his neck. It does make you pause for thought. By 1831, I suppose the French had really had their fill of triumphalist political pictures. People, you know, scaling barricades or looking triumphant in battle, say, for example, Napoleon. This seemed to strike a completely different note. I mean, is it the case that for the French, it was really only possible to look at the painful recent events via the lens of not only distant history, but also foreign history?
Yes, I think that's true. And it's true that also Cromwell had become, you could say, a hot topic in the late 1820s because Victor Hugo had written a play on Cromwell which could not be performed. And it couldn't be performed because the people who might have put it on were afraid of the sort of reaction in terms of censorship that this would seem to be celebrating a regicide. And what is striking, really, it takes the next revolution, that of 1848, before de la Roche, for example, can take the subject of Marie Antoinette and many other painters too. In other words, the events of the revolution do come into the history of picture making, of historical painting, but it's a much later stage. And at this stage, this oblique way of gesturing towards the events of the revolution and the empire has to be the only way.
Thanks to Stephen Bann. It's your last chance to see the Delaroche exhibition. It closes in just a few weeks' time on May the 23rd. A combined exhibition and audio guide ticket costs £11 and is available from the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Do check the website for details of our special guided tours of the show, led by curator Anne Robbins or gallery director Dr. Nicholas Penny. Our next piece continues the theme of revolution. violent political upheavals don't just affect people and institutions. In Europe, at least, they've also heralded movements in art, as the once powerful and wealthy are forced to sell or abandon their private collections. These relocations sometimes cause significant artistic revolutions in turn. Leah Caribbean reports.
I'm here in the National Gallery Library with one of the gallery's research curators, Susanna Avery Quash, to discuss how the French Revolution of 1789 caused a revolution in taste on this side of the Channel when a particular collection of pictures arrived in London. And Susanna, I wonder if you could set the scene for us.
Yes, certainly. Well, the Duke d'Orléans had inherited a wonderful collection of world-class masterpieces, basically from every major European school and in every medium. In fact, 25 pictures now in the National Gallery, including Sebastiano del Piombo's Raising of Lazarus, were among those pictures. So you can see what a wonderful collection it was. Well, during the revolutionary era, when things were getting pretty hot for the aristocrats, he needed money very quickly, and he had to think fast how to get the money and also maintain his political standing. So what he came up with was the idea to sell off his family collection of paintings. It didn't actually serve him very well in the end, because he actually lost his head.
But he sold his collection and it had to leave the country. There was a huge scramble on this side of the Channel, wasn't there, to see if there could be funds raised to get this fantastic collection of pictures.
There were certainly many groups in England that thought it would be a real shame or a lost opportunity not to buy up the marvellous French and Italian pictures. So first of all, there was an art collecting director of the Bank of England, a man called Jeremiah Harman, and he secured the French and Italian pictures from the Orléans collection. For whatever reason, he chose to sell the pictures pretty immediately, and so in the summer of 1798, they were bought by a gentleman art dealer called Michael Bryan for some £43,000. Now, Bryan was in touch with three noblemen, and the main contender of that group was Francis Egerton, the third and last Duke of Bridgewater, and he bought the paintings with two of his relatives.
And this group became known as the Bridgewater Syndicate, didn't it? And tell me a little bit about Bridgewater, because he seems to be a bit of an unlikely character for an art collector.
In fact, he does not seem to have been a very savoury character at all. He was known in his day as a misogynist, a heavy smoker and a hard drinker. And in some contemporary reports, he's recounted as a penny-pinching misanthrope. So it doesn't really seem that he was a likely admirer of old master paintings. But where the painting episode comes in is that he was a wily businessman, and he appears to have bought the paintings as a speculation.
And so this Bridgewater Syndicate buy the pictures, and what happens next?
Well, then the syndicate decide that they are going to retain 94 of the pictures that they consider the real masterpieces. And then they decide that they're going to sell off the rest of the Italian-French pictures. They do this over a seven-month period in 1798, where they hold the collection in two different venues. One collection is held in the Commercial Gallery of Bryan, the dealer, and the other is in the Lyceum in the Strand. Now, several eyewitnesses go and record their reactions to this wonderful spectacle of paintings. For example, the famous critic William Hazlitt, he recalled that a new heaven and a new earth stood before me. The point was that nobody in England really had had the chance for 150 years to see so many old masters in the flesh in one place. The last time had been when Charles I had been executed and his collection had been dispersed.
Do you think it made a difference? Did it really create a revolution in taste?
I think that's not too much to say so, because the point was, before the Orléans collection was put on display, many English people didn't have the chance to see many old masterpieces on their doorstep, and especially not in London. Certain English people in the country got in to see painting collections in the private houses at Houghton, Hocum, Blenheim or Chatsworth, but the average English viewer didn't have that sort of access, and so they would have been restricted possibly to seeing paintings in the London auction houses just when they came up for sale, or through looking at engravings, and that's the only way they would have seen pictures. So by seeing these wonderful things in the flesh gave them a sense of the type of art they could be collecting and what they should be expecting to buy in the future.
But does gallery going become a new social activity?
Yes, I think it certainly does. The important thing about the Bridgewater dynasty is the fact that through their efforts, the British public had a chance to enjoy great masterpieces really for the first time. Bridgewater himself was not a kindly man, and he kept very many of his paintings to himself and did not display them in public. However, his descendants, his nephew and that nephew's second son, were instrumental in opening up their private home in London to the general public. And it was those temporary exhibitions that finally led on to the establishment of permanent exhibitions, for example, the National Gallery.
So from a rather crabby old man, we actually have a great deal to thank him for. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Susanna Avery Quash. To find out more, visit our website and search for Bridgewater. Susanna's posted lots of information about the family and its impact on collecting and display in Britain. You can also find details and images of all our paintings there at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. If you're visiting, we're open 10 till 6 daily and 10 till 9 on Fridays. That's it for now. Until next month, goodbye.